First case on our calendar, 08-1669, State of Ohio versus Darnell Whitfield. Ms. Sobieski.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, and may it please the Court. Kristen Sobieski from the Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office, here on behalf of the appellant, the State of Ohio. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
What's your time there?
For decades, the Ohio legislature, the bar, and the bench have used the term conviction in several different ways. And in this case, the state is asking that this court determine which of those definitions applies to the term conviction as it is used in 2941.25. The state submits that, consistent with this court's recent opinion in Harris, that conviction as it is used in the Allied Offense statute refers to both the finding of guilt and the sentence. And while historically conviction has been used to refer to both the finding of guilt and the sentence, confusion has arisen because occasionally the term conviction is used as shorthand in statutes and in opinions to refer to just that finding of guilt, just the plea, that verdict, the determination of guilt. But as it is applied to the statute, the term conviction must mean both the finding of guilt and the sentence. And that is because this statute is essentially a sentencing limitation. Where a person's conduct constitutes two offenses that are of similar import, the person can be indicted, they can be tried, and they can be found guilty of both, but they can only be sentenced on one.
Well, counsel, where did the Court of Appeals go wrong?
Where the Court of Appeals went wrong is using the term conviction when they vacated, after finding that the offenses were allied, vacating the conviction. Because when you say vacate conviction,
well,
you're implying...
Let me read to you what they said. Allied offenses of similar import do not merge until sentencing, since convictions consist of verdict and sentence. You don't disagree with that statement.
Where I disagree with the Court of Appeals' opinion is in their order of remand.
Okay, but you...
I agree.
You say that's a correct statement of law.
That is a correct statement of law.
Right.
But then they went ahead and vacated the entire conviction, which then, of course, implies the finding of guilt and the sentence. That's where the court went wrong.
And that's the reason I didn't, as you know, I didn't vote to allow this case in the merits. I didn't see an issue for us to decide that. I mean, Gapin says exactly that. And the Court of Appeals may have erred by its remand, by vacating technically. But there's no different, there's no law for us to write here, is there?
I think that there is, Your Honor, because I think that we're having some confusion in these appellate decisions and in the trial court's determinations in vacating and dismissing these findings of guilt. And that's where we're going wrong, and that's where we need some direction. Those factual findings of guilt, whether it's a jury determination, a bench trial, a plea, that should be left intact on both of the offenses. The case proceeds to sentencing on one offense. So where we're going wrong, where we need law that is clear and gives some direction, is in the once the offenses are determined to be allied, state gets to choose which one we go to sentencing on, and the other one is simply set aside. We do not dismiss, we do not vacate that finding of guilt. That finding of guilt has got to be left intact.
Is this a problem in other courts of appeals or just in the court of appeals in which you work?
Well, Your Honor, as preparing for argument today, I'm seeing cases from all over the state where we're saying conviction is vacated. And that's what this case is about this morning.
Instead of saying merge, they're saying vacated.
They're vacating or dismissing that finding of guilt, and that's where we're going wrong. We have a lot of confusion because, again, this term conviction, we use it to mean several different things. Sometimes we do use it as shorthand referring to just that finding of guilt. When we say that in an opinion, though, when a court of appeals says it or when a trial court says it in their journal entry, it's actually incorrect because conviction means both the finding plus the sentence.
Ms. Sobieski, I'm confused about the findings of guilt. There were four in this case, am I right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And if I understand your response to the Chief and Justice Pfeiffer's questions, you don't object to the sentence being imposed on two of the four, is that right?
That's right.
Okay. What is the effect of a finding of guilt if there is no sentence attached to it? What's the legal impact of that?
There, For the defendant's purposes, it is of no effect to him. To his benefit, it is of no effect to him. But it must be left.
You say to his benefit. There's a finding that he's guilty of something.
Yes.
He's not convicted of it.
Right.
And he's not sentenced on it.
That's correct.
Why does the state care that there be a finding on such a count if there's no legal effect to that finding?
For several reasons. First of all, we have the fact finder has determined that the defendant's conduct has constituted violations of both offenses. So it would be false on the facts to completely vacate one of those factual determinations. Secondly, we need to preserve that finding, that determination of guilt, because if there is some legal infirmity in the count that goes forward and is appealed, for example, and there's for some reason that count needs to be vacated, the state should be able to proceed to sentencing on that remaining, the allied offense.
Is it your view that the counts merge?
Merge, again, is a, by merge, I mean there is one sentence. Merge is sort of a confusing.
There are two convictions. In this instance, there were four findings of guilt. And those four findings merge into two convictions on which sentence should be imposed. Is that
yes.
Your view of it?
Yes, Your Honor. Absolutely. But again, by merge, meaning there is one sentence.
Does the merge operate by operation of law, or does it take an act of a trial court or a motion of a party for that to occur, in your view?
Well, in order to determine whether the offenses are allied to begin with, would be a motion of the party asking the court to define that the elements align, or whether or not to determine whether or not there was a separate act or animus in a particular case. That is all decisions, legal determinations that need to be made by the court prior to imposing the sentence. So again, by merge, I don't mean vacate or dismiss or get rid of that other factual determination of guilt. By merge, I mean you only go forward on the one count that the state has elected that should proceed to sentencing. So again, merge, we've used that for a number of years, but that's not a term that comes from the statute. That's not.
What's the authority for the state getting to elect which one will be sentenced?
That's, Your Honor, that's longstanding precedent. We've got a number of cases, from this court all throughout the state of Ohio. The state gets to elect prior to the imposition of sentencing. And that's
because. Did the state so elect in this case?
This wasn't determined. These offenses were allied until the time of the appeal. So the discussion wasn't had as far as
state never
electing.
Asked for any such sentencing. The state wanted all four to be sentenced.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then
in the appeal that it was determined that the offenses were allied.
And on remand from the Court of Appeals, the state is seeking the right to ask the trial court or tell the trial court which ones should go forward. Is that the idea?
That is the idea, and the idea is also that we still leave intact that other factual determination of guilt. We don't vacate that. We don't dismiss that as.
But it merges at sentencing.
It does, absolutely. Absolutely.
What kind of impact does that finding of guilt have in the future? Is that something, for example, that would factor into a repeat offender situation or a prior conviction? On something? Is it something that a person would have to report on a form asking if you've ever been convicted of an offense?
No, it would not, because there would not be a conviction with regard to that count, because there was never a sentence imposed. There was never a punishment imposed.
So, counsel, when you say you want to define conviction for purposes of 294125, how would you define the term? And the word actually is, it may be convicted. It isn't, the word conviction isn't used in that particular section.
Right. The word convicted, as it's used in that section, refers to both the termination of guilt and the sentencing. And we know this because this is a sentencing statute. This has to do with double jeopardy protection against multiple punishments. So if we're talking about protecting against multiple punishments, the word convicted, as it's used in the statute, must be referring to the punishment, to the sentence.
Although it could be narrowly construed to refer only to findings.
In other statutes, it's clear that the term is used to refer to just the findings, and we have a number of opinions where courts use the term convicted and sentence when really a conviction is both the plea, verdict, finding, and the sentence.
All right, but we've never really looked at this particular statute before, and there's no case law that you can refer us to on this particular statute, is there?
That's what we're here for this morning, is to determine what definition of convicted are we using in relation to this statute. And the state, of course, does submit this is all about what's constitutionally offensive that this statute is trying to prevent is the punishments, multiple punishments for the same crime.
So if the court vacates a conviction, as it did in this particular situation, what is your view of what the court is doing?
Because conviction must mean both the finding plus the sentence, to vacate the entire conviction implies that you are vacating the finding and the sentence. And that's what the state is asking for, some clarification, some direction from the court. That order of remand should not be vacating that factual determination of guilt. That's the province of the fact finder, and that should remain intact.
But if you're saying that it's both, and the court then says we are vacating both, doesn't that suggest to you that we're going back and we're going back to the very beginning where there's no finding at all?
What the order of remand should look like is it should be vacating the sentences, the multiple sentences for the offenses that are determined to be allied. That's what the order of remand should look like. We are not touching that factual determination of guilt.
So really what you're arguing about here with the Court of Appeals is that it should have said, according to you, it should have said we vacate the sentence.
Absolutely.
As opposed to vacating the conviction.
Absolutely. Because that is exactly the thrust of the state's argument. That other factual determination of guilt has got to remain intact. And there are many reasons for that. We've got to leave the province of the fact finder.
Yeah. Could you follow up on the many reasons for that? I've listened to your answer to Justice O'Donnell and Justice Cupp. And I'm still at sea as to why it makes a difference.
Because, Your Honor, we already know that the state has the duty, the obligation to prosecute all of the offenses that have been violated. So we take those to the grand jury, we get an indictment, we go to trial on those,
And where do you find that?
Well, that would be United States Supreme Court decision in Johnson, you know, many years ago. That's the state's the duty, the obligation to go ahead and prosecute whatever violations of state law have occurred.
You don't dispute that the Court of Appeals made the right choice for you in choosing to say that the possession charge drops and the trafficking charge stays.
No.
That's the choice the prosecution would have made anyway, right?
It is. Very likely it is, Your Honor. I don't dispute that at all.
So what's the harm?
Again, the problem is we must leave intact that factual determination of guilt.
Why?
On the second charge. Because we're invading, there's a distinction between the fact finder's obligation to sort through the facts and determine
what. Why do you think we have the merger statute?
To prevent multiple punishments for the same crime. That's the double jeopardy protection. Multiple punishments for the same crime. There is no constitutional protection against being found guilty of multiple offenses. The constitutional protection comes in, you cannot be punished for more than one where the offenses are allied.
Counsel, if on the trial level, at the time of sentencing, the trial judge dismisses one of the convictions, and in so doing, is dismissing the fact finder's determination of guilt, and merges the sentence, which means to me that the case is subsumed into the case that is being, or the punishment is subsumed into the punishment that is being meted out. And then on appeal, there is some infirmity with the sentence, and it's ordered to remand. Is it your position that by the dismissal on the trial level of one of the convictions, meaning the count, and no sentence attaching, that cannot be resentenced, that is negated, it is off the table?
Yes.
And that's your concern for maintaining the finding of guilt by the fact finder, even though there is no sentence connected to that finding of guilt.
That is precisely it, Your Honor. And if I could just reserve a few seconds then for rebuttal.
Counsel, you said that you have a constitutional obligation to bring every charge against the defendant. Is that right?
It's the duty of the prosecutor's office, yes.
So did you charge him with running a stop sign?
No, Your Honor.
So that didn't seem to bother you.
We were prosecuting on all of the felonies that were committed. So it's up to the prosecutor's office to decide and elect which offenses it takes to the grand jury to secure an indictment. And again, we take all of those. It's in the state's interest, the public interest, to prosecute those cases. Every charge that we bring as fully as we can. One full and fair opportunity to try the case.
Thank you, Ms. Sobieski. Mr. Cahoon.
May it please the court, I need to begin today with an apology and a correction. In Appellee's brief, footnotes 26 through 29 reference State versus Osborne, as well as one time on page 8 in the text. Those references should be to State versus Henderson, which is otherwise referenced in Appellee's brief, not State versus Osborne. That being said, Appellee would ask the court to hold today that conviction for the purposes of the multi-count statute, 2941-25, means a finding of guilt, and that consequently dismissal of one allied count is not error. In the alternative, the appellee would ask this court to find that dismissal is an appropriate remedy for an allied count which the state has elected not to pursue, as has been this court's jurisprudence since 1929. However, to understand the definition of conviction advanced by the appellee, one has to engage in some statutory interpretation.
Counsel, let me interrupt you there to ask you the same threshold question that I posed to Ms. Sobieski. Do you agree with her that this is an issue that needs to be decided by the Supreme Court because there is uncertainty in the districts or in the trial courts?
Yes, Your Honor, I do agree with Ms. Sobieski on that point. I do believe there is uncertainty as to whether the appropriate remedy is to dismiss the allied count or whether merger, as this court has talked about it in the past, means simply to leave a finding of guilt hanging in limbo and to enter a single sentence on the main count which the state elects.
If the trial court dismisses the hanging count, as you call it, and it goes up in the Court of Appeals, and there's found to be an error in the count that proceeded forward to conviction and sentencing, and it's sent back down, in your opinion, is the opportunity lost then to go back and resentence on the other finding of guilt?
Yes, the opportunity is lost to resentence on the other finding of guilt.
So the state's concern is genuine in that regard, in terms of there is an effect on the sentence if part of the sentence is hanging only on the count that goes forward.
The state's concern is genuine, though to characterize it in just that way understates the scope of the state's normal remedies. If an issue is overturned on appeal, normally the state has the opportunity to retry that issue on appeal without any implications of the double jeopardy rights of the defendant. That is the state's traditional remedy, which has been applied since time immemorial, and this certainly would not change that at all.
But if we rule that the other count continues to remain on the books as a finding of guilt, then they could elect to go back and just be sentenced on that and not have to go back and do an entire retrial.
Possibly. I believe that's a separate determination for this court to make. As far as the appellee's been able to note, and also the state did not note in their brief, any example where an offense has been overturned on appeal, has gone back, and an allied offense previously merged has been unmerged and then sentenced upon separately.
What is the effect then on your defendant, your client, of having the hanging count? Is there any practical effect? Is there any, as was asked, any reporting requirements, any jeopardy to jobs, other collateral effect?
I think the effects would be almost entirely collateral in that they would accrue in society. When someone is seeking a job, there certainly would be a public record showing that there had been a finding of guilt made on that allied offense. And the whole idea behind allied offenses is that they are identical. They are the same offense. We are giving the state the opportunity to present it in multiple different ways to make sure that the state is not thwarted from bringing a defendant to justice for some sort of violation of the law that they have engaged in. Having multiple findings of guilt remaining on a defendant's record suggests that a defendant has committed additional crime above and beyond the single crime which the defendant committed.
Well, counsel, the fact finder has determined that there was committed by that defendant a variety of crimes. And that's not expunged in any way upon this single sentencing, the merged sentence, is it?
No, if the sentence is merged by leaving a finding of guilt in and entering a single sentence, it is not expunged in any way. However, if that count is dismissed, then that is, in a sense, expunged, and the record reflects that that's been dismissed. And also, I believe
are you saying that the merger statute to guard against multiple sentencing is also intended to guard against multiple findings of guilt? That's the policy behind that statute?
Yes. First, I would like to recharacterize the statute. One, the term merger is not used anywhere in the statute or anywhere in a related way in the revised code. Merger is a common law doctrine that this court applied in the past when the legislature specifically imposed conviction on all offenses from the period between 1929 to 1974. It has common law roots, and once the criminal code became enshrined in statute, things have changed. The multi-count statute only talks about conviction. The question is, what is conviction? And once we decide what conviction is, the question then is merger, as this court has looked at it in the recent past, the appropriate way of dealing with that conviction, or is dismissal? Back in the case State versus Botta, just prior to the 1974 law that is the present law as well, this court applied merger, and in applying that, the court said that there was no error in the court dismissing the unelected count. There was not a merger where the finding of guilt remained, and there was only a single sentence on the main count. The finding of guilt did not remain because it was dismissed. The court held specifically that it was not error in that case. Also, the definition of conviction is a bit more contentious than merely reflected by the state's argument. Almost all of the current case law that suggests the criminal rule 32C, judgment of conviction, is a conviction for the purpose of the multi-count statute, cites back to State versus Henderson. In State versus Henderson, this court was not looking at the multi-count statute. The court was looking at what constitutes a conviction for the purposes of penalty enhancement of an offense from an F5 to an F4. 10 years later, this court picked up the issue again of what constitutes a conviction in State versus Cash. In Cash, this court was looking at the context, again, not of the multi-count statute, but of what constitutes a conviction for the purposes of impeachment under Evidence Rule 609. There, this court found that a conviction means merely a finding of guilt, and that Henderson was related only to penalty enhancement. This court cited the United States Supreme Court for that proposition, which noted that a pleading of guilty differs, it was a pleading of guilty in that case, differs in effect from a mere admission or extrajudicial confession. It is itself a conviction, like a verdict of a jury. The words of the Supreme Court, which this state cited in State versus Cash. As recently as last year, even in looking in Criminal Rule 32C to define a judgment of conviction, this court took up the issue of what a conviction means in State versus Baker. This court here said, the normal definition, looking at Black's Law Dictionary, for a conviction ordinarily refers exclusively to a finding of guilt, exclusively the language of this court. This court then went on to explain that there are four ways a person can be convicted, which is what is prohibited by the multi-count statute. Those four ways are on a guilty plea, on a no-contest plea with a finding of guilt, on a jury trial with a verdict of guilt, or on a bench trial with a verdict. That conviction is what takes place here when the jury enters a finding of guilt, regardless of whether there is a sentence imposed on each count or whether they are merged under the previous common law doctrine. That conviction is what the appellee seeks to prevent from happening. Now, appellee must note that if that definition of conviction is adopted by this court, it will necessitate a change in trial practice, in that the committee comments to the multi-count statute state that the state must at some point elect which count it will proceed on. Right now, under State versus Harris and previous law, the state elects after the finding of guilt but prior to the sentence. If the conviction, as appellee has just argued, and certainly has argued in the brief, means the finding of guilt by the jury, that election must take place before the finding of guilt by the jury, meaning the state must elect before the case is submitted to the jury. Now, at first blush, it may seem that the defense is, or that the appellant in this case, is attempting to take away from the state some of the powers granted by the multi-count statute. However, upon closer examination, nothing could be further from the truth. The state gains a significant advantage from the multi-count statute in that it's able to bring its single offense in many alternative ways to make sure that if the evidence plays out at trial in a way the state was not expecting, that the state is not thwarted from entering a conviction.
Well, counsel, let me ask you then, if you stated that the prosecution has to select before the matter is subjected to the jury.
Yes, Your Honor.
And what happens then if they decide that we're going to, what happens if the jury comes back and does not find a finding of guilt on the count that the prosecutor is hanging their hat on, and they find a finding of guilt on an alternative count that under normal circumstances, if they would have found guilty on both, would have only had one sentencing?
Right.
How do you address that scenario?
Well, one, that scenario under what the appellee is suggesting is impossible to take place because only one will ultimately go to the jury. If the jury finds the defendant not guilty on that count, it would be speculation to suggest that on an alternative theory, the jury would have found the defendant guilty. Remember, the idea behind allied offenses is that the offenses are identical. It is the same offense, but described in different manners. So if the jury were to find the defendant not guilty on that count, that would be an acquittal.
So both counts don't go to the jury and the prosecutor's already just identified the one they're going to run with.
Correct.
You're saying that only one, at the close of evidence, the prosecutor has to make a decision as to, even though they've got the evidence that would support, theoretically, both counts, it's got to make a selection then and send only that one to the jury.
Yes. In enacting the multi-count statute, the legislature said that the state may bring these counts in the alternative, even though they constitute the same offense.
What's the point then of a multi-count indictment?
The point of a multi-count indictment is to give the state the opportunity to make sure the evidence plays out the way the state expects it will at trial. I know I've certainly run into a number of cases where a witness testifies differently than the state expected, and the state finds that they are not able to sustain a count that they initially thought was meritorious. The multi-count statute makes sure that the state is not hindered by that by allowing the state to bring an account in the alternative. The state can take every count entirely through the trial process up into the jury's determination of guilt, make sure that if the defense so requests, the judge has the opportunity to review the sufficiency of the evidence to make sure that that evidence meets the basic level of sufficiency. After that point, the state can elect upon which account it will move forward. That is the benefit to the state.
I don't quite understand how you claim their definition of conviction forces that decision before it goes to the jury. I didn't get that at all from their definition of conviction. Their definition of conviction simply is that the count that is chosen to go forward gets the sentence, but you don't dismiss the other count. It just simply is a hanging chad, I guess.
It's a fair characterization. Under the method proposed by the state, it does not have to be decided before it goes to the jury. Under the method proposed by the state, this would be elected after the finding of guilt but prior to the sentence. Because the conviction, which is what's prohibited by the multi-count statute, by the state's definition, does not exist until there is both a finding of guilt and a sentence. The difference is if the conviction means purely the finding of guilt, a conviction exists as soon as the jury returns that finding of guilt.
I didn't get that to be what they were saying, though.
That's not what the state is arguing.
Okay.
That's a necessary implication of the appellee's argument for the definition of conviction.
You're taking it to the next level.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, counsel, you're the appellee here.
That's correct.
But you disagree with what the Court of Appeals said on page 13 of their opinion. Allied offenses of similar import do not merge until sentencing, since a conviction consists of the verdict and sentence.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So, as the appellee, you want us to write something that says the Court of Appeals' opinion is wrong, but their result was right. Is that your position?
That is the appellee's position. In the alternative, if this court would not like to take such a broad reading of this issue at this moment, in this particular posture, The appellee would suggest that it would also be appropriate for this court to say that dismissal is an appropriate remedy in the case of allied offenses. Well, merger was an old common law doctrine that applied prior to the current multi-count statute. Dismissal has been used since 1929 and has been used recently by this court in State versus Yarbrough.
Let's just take your defendant's situation. It seems to me you're asking the prosecution to, they think for some reason they can get them on possession or on trafficking, mm-hmm. right?
That's correct. They did.
And they got them on trafficking, but it was mostly circumstantial evidence, right?
Well, circumstantial evidence, if believed, certainly has an equal value to direct evidence.
Right. But that could have been a high-risk gamble in this case. And you're saying, you know, if they want to go for the most serious offense, they mm-hmm. risk, if he's not found guilty on that, of not even getting them forth possession, which he clearly was guilty of. I mean,
certainly, the state makes a certain calculus when it decides what to charge, what to go with. I mean, that's the calculus normally engaged in by the state when it decides where to offer a plea bargain or what sort of plea to offer. If the state thinks that its case is weak on a particular charge and it's uncertain of the outcome, and there is another charge, which would be something similar to a lesser included, that the state feels more comfortable with, then that's why the state has the opportunity to choose which one of those charges it will move forward with. If the state thinks that in this case, for whatever the reason, that the greater penalty attaching to the higher charge is what is appropriate, then the state certainly is welcome to move forward with that, as it's the state's choice which charge to move forward with. However, there's nothing mandating that the state always has to go with the highest charge. I think to suggest that the role of the prosecutor's office is to always indict a defendant on all of the highest charges possible is perhaps a bit disingenuous.
Well, but coming back to your case, this guy's got a bunch of crack in the glove box. He's got a loaded gun in the glove box, and he's got $6,000 in his pocket. Now, we wouldn't think much of a prosecutor that didn't at least try to convict him on trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
And you're suggesting, if that's unsuccessful, that they've also kissed goodbye getting them on possession, which they've got them dropped dead on.
Well, one alternative not taken up in this case is the concept of lesser included offenses, which has been dealt with separately from allied offenses. It's taken up under a different criminal rule. It has a different body of law. While it's always possible that the court might be able to bring up a lesser included offense, the state could bring a basic plus a lesser included, and certainly those could both go back to the jury if the state was uncertain of whether the greater offense would result in a conviction.
Before you sit down, Mr. Cohen, I just want to ask you to try to address whether there is any legal significance to a finding of guilt by itself with no punishment.
Your Honor, I don't believe that there is any legal significance to a finding of guilt standing alone. I think the significance is only on the collateral impact on the defendant in seeking jobs, housing, other things in outside society.
I thought earlier you said a judgment, or that would be a conviction, a finding of guilt.
Well, if this court were to adopt the state's interpretation of conviction, then I think the finding of guilt standing alone in isolation does not have additional legal effect. Certainly under the appellee's argument, the finding of guilt is itself the conviction and therefore does have legal effect, would result in penalty enhancement in future cases, could be used for specifications like repeat violent offender. It does have a separate meaning under the appellee's argument. I was addressing the state's argument there, and I apologize if I was unclear.
Can you think of a job that he might qualify for and would pass muster on when he reports on his application, I've been convicted of trafficking in drugs, but he would be better, he'd have a better shot at the job if he didn't have to report he was convicted of both trafficking and possession and then just reported the trafficking?
Certainly, Your Honor. I think any employer looking at a criminal history is likely to look at a greater criminal history and eye a candidate with greater skepticism. I don't think that requires a particular concrete example, but I think someone who has multiple findings of guilt, an employer is more likely to see that person as untrustworthy or a high-risk employee.
Thank you, Mr. Cohen. Thank you. Ms. Sobieski, you've used your time, which may take 30 seconds.
Your Honors, where two offenses are found to be allied, dismissal of the finding of guilt is not the appropriate remedy. It's the dismissal of that second sentence that is appropriate.
Counsel, how many courts of appeals take that position?
I think that's there's confusion because we're using
because
that conviction.
Because there are a number of courts of appeals that do take the position that upon the motion, the sentence is imposed on one and the other count is dismissed, correct?
Yes, so there's okay. confusion because different courts are using dismissal and vacating, referring to both sentence or referring to conviction. So we're split, and that's why we need some clarification from the court. It is the multiple punishments that are constitutionally offensive, and it's by adopting the state's proposition that we would preserve the defendant's protection against cumulative punishments, and we would also be preserving the determinations of guilt. And we respectfully request that you adopt our proposition of law. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sobieski. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.